toured the studios of some of Fargo Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free event is October 5th and 6th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, and more, all demonstrating their work. Find the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street, just before a holiday weekend. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Later in our show today, Matt Olien reviews the movie Blink Twice. It's a feel-good story, until it's not. Boy, does it have an unexpected twist. Plus, Dave Thompson will be here to break down this week's latest news with me. But first, with fall and winter just on the horizon and Labor Day weekend just around the corner, it's a perfect time to revisit one of our favorite recent conversations. Our friend Don Kinsler, an expert horticulturalist and an NDSU extension agent, shares essential tips on how to prepare your yards and gardens for the colder months that are ahead. Don, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We are at your beautiful home in Fargo. I see flowers just in their full bloom everywhere, and we're standing right next to your lawn fertilizer. Don, you're getting ready for fall here?
Well, you know, it's a great time of year, and of course, as we look towards the end of summer and start getting ready for fall, a few things that we should start getting ready for fall, and one of those is lawn fertilizer. The target date is around Labor Day. So kind of now is a good time to start getting your fertilizer spreader out. And the fall fertilizing of lawns has been shown by turf researchers to be the number one most important time of the year, even more important than the spring fertilizer, to put the fertilizer on the lawn. Because it's this fall fertilizer that will help the grass to have deep roots, and the grass will fill out and thicken out sideways. And so much of next year's lawn will depend on this fall, the lawn grass getting energy and thickening up and getting all the good stuff, the deep roots, that next year, next spring, will make it come forth so very, very important. So again, Labor Day is the target. This time of year, garden centers and national chain hardware stores oftentimes will have a fall winterizer type fertilizer. It means that the nutrients, the three main nutrients that you see the numbers on the fertilizer bag, which are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, which grass needs in the highest quantities, it means that those fertilizer elements have been adjusted a little bit with some extra to help root growth and things like that. So they've been tweaked a little bit. So the fall fertilizers, the kind of winterizer type fertilizers, have been adjusted a little bit. But there's nothing wrong with using, if you've got some leftover from spring, there's nothing wrong with using that same spring type fertilizer on your lawn as well.
You have a classic drop spreader, and I had to buy my first fertilizer system earlier, and I purchased one that broadcasts, but I found lines in it. How can I avoid that when I put my fertilizer down?
Well, you know, the nice thing about the newer types of drop spreaders have little arrows right up on the top, and the directions say that when you're following along with your fertilizer spreader, you can see where the wheels leave kind of little tracks, and you line up the arrows on top of the drop spreader with where your previous wheel track was, and then it lays it down precisely without leaving spaces or gaps. And we talk about drop spreaders, and a drop spreader is a fertilizer spreader that, as it says, it just drops the fertilizer right down underneath the hopper. I prefer these instead of the type called a cyclone. The cyclone spreaders whirl the fertilizer out.
And kind that's of, what I purchased.
Yeah, they whirl it out in an area. Some of them, as you get close to your sidewalks and driveways, they spread the fertilizer also. They whirl it out across those. And of course, fertilizer can be kind of caustic to concrete. And so then you need to sweep it off of those hard surfaces. The drop spreaders drop it exactly over the path that you're traveling. So that's why I prefer those.
I had a friend who lives in Grand Forks tell me this summer that if you have to pick between fertilizing and aerating your yard, and you can only pick one, he said that aeration is more important. Would you agree with that?
You know, I wouldn't. I'd opt for the fertilizer, for the nutrition. But, you know, it's kind of one of those, you know, which of your kids is your favorite? And I would prefer to do both. A sequence that you might do those in, especially if your lawn is hard packed, or maybe you feel like there's kind of a thatch buildup and fertilizer and nutrients and water just aren't getting down in, the core aeration or even a power raking can be done in late August, early September, and that opens up the turf so that when you apply the fertilizer, it will actually go down. And to your friend's comments, you know, if it's very hard and compacted so that the fertilizer wouldn't even find its way into the root system, then absolutely the core aeration would probably be more important if the fertilizer wouldn't even make it down to the root system.
Yeah, but a beautiful yard, you depend on Mother Nature to do your watering, so you'll have to time when you fertilize.
We do. Because the granular type fertilizers need water in order to dissolve into a solution that will go down into the root system that the turf roots can drink on up. And so without water, those fertilizer granules basically just sit there. One nice thing about fertilizing around Labor Day is that we'll usually get some fall rains that come. If we don't, it's important to irrigate half an inch to an inch at least to dissolve those granules and get them down in. And we don't have a sprinkler system on our lawn. I kind of save the water for the potted type things and the flower beds and the vegetable garden. And so I do let Mother Nature take its course. Our own non-watered lawn has started to take on kind of a brownish tint where it goes a little bit dormant. It'll come out of that when we get moisture. That's why it's so important to time that either with Mother Nature's rain or being willing to water it in.
What did you do new this season in your yard? You have beautiful flowers everywhere. Did you change it up a little bit?
Yeah, we always enjoy, my wife Mary and I enjoy trying a few different kinds of flowers, maybe some new types of things. One of the newer types of flowers that we've grown is one called Bee's Knees Petunia. Just a beautiful yellow, bright, vibrant that works so well in pots and planters. And so we enjoy trying something a little different each year. We always add a few different types of perennials that we haven't had before. And of course, one of the main goals, not new this year, but always on the top of my goals, are to try to keep ahead of the weeds. And heavy emphasis on the word try. But you know, the interesting thing is, and this applies to late summer here, is if we allow weeds to go to seed, those seeds have the ability to remain in the soil and come back for many, many years. In fact, the purslane, the low-growing weed that is so common in vegetable gardens and flower beds, that low-growing purslane, one purslane plant can produce hundreds of thousands of seeds. They can shoot them out when the little seed heads pop. They can shoot them out up to about 40 feet away, and they can remain viable in the soil, germinating for the next 25 years or so. So I take quite seriously trying to prevent weeds from going to seed.
How do you do that?
A lot of hand pulling and digging. In fact, before you got here, I use a hand kneeler. I'm over mid-60s. Uh-huh. And so a kneeler just works so great. You know, for once your knees don't bounce back the way they do when you're 18, but a hand kneeler, and I use an old butcher knife and take a 5-gallon bucket, and then I kneel beside the weeds with my long butcher knife, try to get the roots and all, and then put them in my 5-gallon bucket and dispose of them not right by the area. For example, if you pull a weed and leave it right beside, chances are there might be some seed that'll continue to ripen and pollute that area with weed seed.
We are about 15, 20 feet away from a big pile of wood chips. You're going to add some mulch to some
yes.
of your flower beds?
You know, a great time of year in the late summer, early fall. You know, sometimes spring is so busy. You know, you're busy planting, you're busy getting things kind of ready, planting vegetables, planting flowers. And so I got a truckload of wood chips. It's shredded wood type mulch. I really enjoy this for especially perennial flower beds and around your landscape shrubs. And I got this from a tree removal company. So when they remove trees for people, oftentimes they will shred up the material and then sell it. So contact your local tree removal people. And so what I do with this shredded mulch is I create a layer in the perennial bed and around landscape shrubs, a layer at least 5 inches thick. 5 inches thick, because it's going to settle a little, and you need a layer that thick to prevent weed growth. If it's much thinner, or if it's settle much thinner, the weeds are going to be able to come right through that.
Fall is the time that I wouldn't think about adding mulch to my bed.
Exactly. And a reason I do it is, you know, a little more time. You know, spring is pretty intensive for gardening and lots of other things. There's pruning, planting, lots of other things. And so now is the time when it's a little slower and I can tackle some of the things. Now, underneath the mulch, I do one of two things. If it's a, for example, a row of lilacs that I don't want the grass and the weeds to be growing in and around, I will lay weed block fabric, you know, the black kind of woven type fabric, lay that down and put about 5 inches of mulch over that. In a perennial bed where you're kind of digging, dividing, moving perennials around, I don't want the black fabric that I'm going to have to deal with when I dig up and move things around, because that's kind of a little bit of a permanent type material. So I use cardboard. You know, I get cardboard from the local recycling drop-offs, you know, or if people have boxes, I just cut them down, you know, lay them flat cardboard. And that works quite nicely. I lay that right down on the ground and then put about 5 inches of the shredded wood mulch on that. What that does is it gives a little more teeth to the weed blocking. For example, things like quackgrass, thistles, things that can come back with a vengeance. I use that cardboard underneath just to give a little more teeth to the weed control. And in about 3 years, that cardboard disintegrates just into a nice organic material on the soil. And in the meantime, it has pretty much smothered any weeds that were below it. And then when you go to move perennials, you know, dig, divide, plant some more, the cardboard is much easier to underneath to cut. Even if it's still intact, you can cut it and kind of move it a little easier than you would weed fabric for a perennial bed.
We planted two rows of hedges on each side of our property. They were bare root. We got them from the Cass County Conservation Program.
Soil Conservation District. Great program.
Yeah, absolutely. They pay 75% of the cost. It's an inexpensive way to do that, but they're still really small. They're growing. They're doing well, but should I do anything for winter protection for those little guys, or just hope they come back next year?
Yeah, one of the best things you can do is keep the grass from growing next to them. Grass is a really big hog. You know, it takes the nutrients.
I've been afraid to trim around those with my trimmer because I'm afraid I'm going to break them.
Because that is so common. You know, when the grass grows around, the grass gets kind of tall, and then if you try to do with a weed trimmer, the weed trimmers can just scar and scratch and permanently injure little trees and shrubs. And so the weed barrier fabric just works so well. And you can put that down even after you've planted. You can go along and kind of slice it where the little shrubs or little trees were, and so you can fit that around. I would go at least a minimum of 12 inches on either side.
And then mulch on top?
And then mulch on top. Yep, the shredded bark on top. You don't need to do that. For example, the shelter belt plantings that they do, they usually do put that weed barrier fabric on those and pin them down with staples, the fabric. And in a field shelter belt, that weed barrier fabric is usually just left without mulch on top, you know, for a field windbreak. But just to make it look a little more appealing in a home, we've done that, and then put the wood chips on top, the wood mulch. I like I say shredded instead of wood chips. The shredded kind of meshes together well.
Is that different than what we're looking at here then?
This is shredded. Mm-hmm. You know, it does have wood chips in it, but the actual, a person can buy bags of wood chips, and the chips tend to kind of float and move, and they don't kind of mesh. The shredded type has more shreds of bark and things that kind of mesh and hold it together. So anyway, back to your young little plantings of shrubs or trees, a couple of things: keeping the grass away, will make mowing, trimming much easier. It will also be healthier. It will increase the growth of those little plants because you won't have the grass hogging the nutrients and the moisture as much. And then also, those are so susceptible to rabbit browsing in the winter.
That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, when there's not a whole lot of other greenery, the twigs and bark of many of those little shrubs and things are so tasty to rabbits or deer if you're in a deer area. So a couple of things you can do. In many areas, you just can't fence. You know, you can't maybe run fences in all those areas. So that leaves us to repellents. Now, no repellents are going to be, and this is a really common question, how do we keep rabbits from doing some of this winter type damage? No repellent is going to be 100%, but there are at least three repellents that have a better track record. They have some science and research behind what they do. Forget the mothballs, forget the Irish Spring soap, forget some of these
the internet is full
brews.
Of this stuff,
exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And so the Soil Conservation District, which takes protecting these windbreak shrubs and trees very seriously, because rabbits and deer could ruin a mile of windbreak in no time. And so they use one called Plant Skid. All one word, PlantSkydd, Plant Skid. And I've seen this at local garden centers. It's actually a blood-based product. I mean, it's not icky. But you see, rabbits and deer are plant eaters. They're herbivores. They don't like things that kind of taste or smell like meat or animal products. So Plant Skid is the soil conservation's product of choice. Another one with kind of similar research is the one called Liquid Fence. That is based on rotten eggs, rotten milk, maybe some garlic thrown in for good measure. But you see, again, animal-based product. And a third one is called Repel X that gardeners have had good success. So those three, again, none of them are going to be 100%, but they give us an edge versus not doing anything. There is also a University of Minnesota, our sister university, has done quite a bit of research, rabbit deer repellent, and they've got a homemade one that they said works quite effectively, and that is in a gallon, put 3 eggs, mix it up really, really well, and that alone has proven to be a pretty good, because again, the eggs, you know, an animal type product, the deer and rabbits just don't like that smell.
And so that is
sprayed directly on the little shrubs or trees that you want to protect. So that is a home remedy that does have some science and some research, a track record of working.
We're enjoying our conversation with North Dakota State University's Cass County Extension agent, horticulturist Don Kinsler. Don, is it too late for me to plant some trees or some bushes?
Oh, the fall. Coming up late summer and early fall is a great time to visit the garden centers and planting trees, shrubs, perennials. Now, we should target early September if you can. Some advantages of fall planting are the weather. Temperatures started usually getting a little cooler, you know, the nights have a little crispness to them, and it just works really well to plant. Now, when I say kind of target the first part of September or so, that gives those trees or shrubs or perennials all of September and most of October to root in. See, even if when we have air frosts, the soil isn't going to freeze down until probably early November sometime. And so the roots are going to continue to grow.
Do I need to continue watering that late into the season then?
You need to continue watering. Of course, as the temperatures get lower, evaporation is less, you might only need to water once every 2 weeks. If there's some moisture there in the soil when you dig down a little with your fingers, no need to water. And so evaporation is much less.
Can I overwater your trees?
You sure can. For example, sometimes, no matter what time of year it is, on shrubs, trees, perennials, we're so afraid that we're going to neglect those. And so sometimes it might be tempting to water every day just to make sure that this plant has what it needs. But more trees, shrubs are killed by overwatering than underwatering, because the root system needs oxygen, and if that soil is continually saturated, it just virtually drowns the root system. So even in the high summer, once a week, a good thorough soaking, the equivalent of maybe a 5-gallon bucket, on a tree, 2 5-gallon buckets. And so sometimes take the garden hose and see how long it takes to fill a 5-gallon bucket. It's longer than sometimes we anticipate. So thorough waterings. And then in the fall also, you know, you might not have to water quite as often, but even in the middle of summer, you know, once a week, but not daily watering.
We purchased a tree through Horace's program that they allow you to purchase a tree a year for like $75. And they put those sacks of water. How long should we be adding water to those in the season?
They're great. You know, when you fill them up, they give that nice slow trickle. I think each, depending on what brand, I think they hold 10 to 15 gallons, I think. So a nice slow trickle, that's the deep, slow soaking we're talking about. You know, if you do it by 5-gallon bucket, you just slowly pour it on. But okay, how far into the season? You'll continue into August, you know, and how often? You know, not more than maybe once a week. And then start tapering off as, you know, as August is gone. Start tapering off, because that also helps the trees or shrubs kind of toughen in. The gardening term is hardening off, you know, getting ready for winter time. So a little bit of drying of the soil. So where maybe during the summer you were filling that every 7 to 10 days, a taper off to every 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks or so. Don't let them go into fall dry. If we do get some rains, if we do get an inch of rain, that really substitutes for one of your waterings.
Do I need to continue that into year 2 and 3 and 4 with that same system? And also, we had then some stakes on either side of the tree that hold it, you know, tied in strong
winds. Oh, and that was important this year, because with our saturated soils earlier, if young trees weren't staked and given some support, saturated soils, many young trees with some of the winds we had just developed a 45 degree slant. They just could totally, and the soil was so soupy, it gave no resistance. And so I've got a couple of trees that are aimed at a 45 degree angle because I didn't have them staked.
How many years do I need to do that?
About 2, not more than 2. The first season for sure, and then it'll get some good root systems, a good root system intact that'll help to hold it and stabilize it. And the second year if you want, but usually the first year for sure. And the second year, if it looks like everything's stable, you can take it off. So not more than 2 growing seasons at most.
Don, we just have a minute or 2 left. As you drive around and you see new trees that folks have planted, is there 1 or 2 types of trees you're thinking to yourself, oh, I wish they wouldn't have planted that here in North Dakota?
Definitely.
That I should stay away from? Which trees are those?
Autumn blaze maple.
They're so pretty though, in the pictures.
Autumn blaze maple. And the reason for that is, if we take a look at the upper Midwest, from east of the Red River Valley, those soils were a naturally forested type soils. You drive through areas in Minnesota and on east into the United States where you see these big forests. From the Red River Valley and on west, you don't see that. This area was prairie grassland, and it did not have the moisture and the soil type to sustain big forests. You'd see trees along the rivers and along the little creeks and draws, but not widespread forests. And so, getting back to the autumn blaze and some of the maples that turn bright colors in the fall of the year, this soil type, they resent. They're a type of tree that is very sensitive, and they might do well, but they might not. It's considered a roll of the dice. But probably 3/4 of the autumn blaze maples I get questions about because they're doing poorly. And it's very hard to amend the soil enough because pretty soon those roots are going way out. So trying to amend the soil to make it like a forested type soil is like trying to change the color of the ocean by adding some food coloring to it. So what I suggest is, of course, we all love fall color. Plant a buckeye instead. Plant the tree buckeye. It's not so sensitive to soil. NDSU and University of Minnesota, South Dakota State University have all developed cultivars of buckeye. And so garden centers do carry them. For example, NDSU has one called Prairie Torch, which is a beautiful one. University of Minnesota, South Dakota State. So look for buckeye. They develop a beautiful orange color and they're adapted to our soil type.
Don, if people have questions, how can they send those questions to you?
Yeah, best way is email me, donald.kinzler, K-I-N-Z-L-E-R, at ndsu.edu.
It's always a pleasure to visit your beautiful home and garden.
Great to have you here.
Thanks again.
It's always fun to talk gardening.
Thanks again for joining us on Main Street.
Yeah, thank you much.
Coming up after the break, Madeline dives into Blink Twice, a feel-good movie that takes an unexpected turn. Stay tuned for Matt's take on this surprising film and our review of this week's news with the legend, Dave Thompson. He's Prairie Public's news director. That's all ahead on Main Street with no turns required on your radio dial. That's all right after this.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather around everybody.
And with that music, we know it's time to talk to the legend. That's our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Glad to be here.
All right, Dave, the Buffaloes are playing the Bison tonight. Safe to say that a large American mammal will win.
I think you're right on that. But that's going to be interesting because that's Coach Prime of the Colorado
time.
Buffaloes.
That's absolutely true. And a new era with a new coach for the NDSU Bison, too. So
that is correct. And, yeah, you know, NDSU has been talking about going Division One.
Well, they'll get a taste of it tonight.
You bet.
From probably what will be a fairly strong team, certainly for its first opponent.
That's for sure.
Dave, we review the news each week, and let's start. Cass County has a solar project that was considered a few years ago and now is being revived.
Right. The project is called Harmony Solar, and it would be up to 200 megawatts of power.
What does that mean, Dave? What is 200 megawatts?
That's a good question. I use megawatts a lot. A normal power plant is around 450 megawatts.
So about half.
About half. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, it's green, renewable energy. And it was permitted by the Public Service Commission back in February 2019. Well, nothing happened. And all of a sudden, there's more interest in it now. They're not saying too much about who might be looking to purchase power from this solar facility. But apparently, they've got a renewed interest in it. And the Public Service Commission is going to look at extending the permit that they gave to Harmony Solar.
And Harmony Solar wants to get right after this, it sounds to me like.
Yeah, it sounds like they want to get going on this project. So apparently, they do have maybe what they call an off-taker. That's the new term for selling power. You have an off-taker.
If I buy power, I'm an off-taker.
That's
all right. Dave, the Grand Forks Fire Department is using drones for tactical and beyond line of sight operations. So interesting to me how technology can impact so many different parts of our lives.
I know, it's really interesting. And when I was presented with this story idea, I couldn't wait to talk to the Grand Forks Fire Department chief. And he explained that they have one drone, and these are tactical, only in emergency situations, using it beyond line of sight. If it's a normal situation, they'll use line of sight, but beyond line of sight, they can do it for, you know, to get behind a
large grass fire.
Exactly.
A place they wouldn't have access to, perhaps.
Or perhaps even if you have a missing person on the Red River,
there you go.
Might be able to use that drone to help find that.
There's a lot of ancillary tech work being done in Grand Forks, of course, relative to these unmanned autonomous devices in many ways, on how to communicate with these devices from tower to tower to tower well beyond the horizon. So I'm wondering if that may factor into this a little bit too.
But it certainly does.
The technology is there now and appropriate use in my eyes.
I know they're working with Grand Sky and Vantis in Grand Forks to make this happen. And this is the first time we're using that beyond line of sight technology and drones for a fire department in North Dakota. But the chief, Gary Lorenz, wants it to be, you know, maybe more ubiquitous across North Dakota. We might see other fire departments do this now.
Sure. And across the country, too, I'm guessing.
Yes.
All right, Dave, we've hung a number on what the passage of a property tax measure may cost the state or require the state to reimburse local governments. And that number is over $3
billion. Yeah, $3.15 billion. That's what the tax commissioner, Brian Krosh, has told Legislative Management Committee, and that's the figure they're going to have in the material that they have for voters when they look at that measure.
Dave, is there panic? I feel we've talked about this a lot, but I feel this has momentum. I just feel it when I talk to friends and folks around about it. Everyone says, well, what about our local governments? Our taxes are too high. We've got to do something about taxes. It's in the national news with the national election. Do you have a feel for momentum that this measure is gaining, perhaps?
You know, I'm hearing a lot of the same comments that the complaint is your property taxes are so high. And it property taxes are potentially, or at least partially, I should say, dependent on valuation of your property. And that's kind of a nebulous thing in some regards. Just an example, I bought my condo. It was $125,000. And now the condos in my quad are selling for $165,000 to $180,000.
Sure.
So property values are going up, and what does that mean for my property taxes? Well, that's where, you know, when you start talking about mills, and there have been proposals to basically say, put a dollar amount on it, and then maybe you know, have more transparency about why property taxes are going up, because schools are dependent on it for their local share. And, of course, roads, bridges, police, fire, that type of thing.
Local government services.
Absolutely. What is not spelled out in the measure, and I don't know if it was deliberately done this way, is how and where does the state get $3.15 billion to do this? Some people have said, what about the legacy fund? Well, there's a measure on the ballot that a legislature can only spend about 5% of the principal of the legacy fund for anything, and they have to do it with a two-thirds vote of both houses of the legislature. So there's going to be a lot of pen to paper, should this pass, to find out where do they find $3.15 billion.
And time will tell. We'll know in November, Dave. That's for sure.
I think so.
Dave, the American Red Cross certainly has been hampered by a blood supply shortage that has now continued on, and you've reported about this.
We have, and we talked about since April, the Red Cross has been basically working day in, day out to respond to more than 19 climate disasters, more than double the average over the last 40 years. Nearly 60 blood drives that were sponsored by the American Red Cross had to be canceled, and that's kind of exacerbated the issue. So, and all blood types are in demand, and they're going to try to get to areas that may not have had as many disasters or effects of the weather, and maybe try to get them to donate blood. And we know blood is in supply all the time, but we're reaching a critical situation here.
I have a very rare type of blood, so I'm on somebody's mailing list when things become...
I'm sure you're right.
Things become short, but the bottom line is if people want to donate, they can. They may have to do a little legwork on their own, but it's something that anyone can do, for sure. Mm-hmm. Dave, a task force now has made some recommendations to better recruit and retain teachers. This is something they've been working on. This is something that is hugely important to the future of education in North Dakota.
Yeah, and their recommendations make a lot of common sense. On-site childcare, mentorship for new teachers, and maximizing benefits. And there's the one thing that has been talked about a lot that probably is not part of this, but the task force has been hearing from teachers that teachers sometimes don't feel respected. And that's probably a bigger national issue, but you hear that as well, that teachers feel like they're not being respected.
This world of social media has really turned the tables on how teachers and parents and others communicate too, and I think that's part of an issue that needs to be continued to be worked on. And this task force, to me, seems like a good place where maybe those discussions can happen down the road.
Absolutely.
What happens with these recommendations now, Dave?
Well, they're going to be taken to potentially for legislative action on that, and especially when you're talking about a mentorship program and on-site childcare. And about benefits, too, that's going to be an interesting question because there have been a lot of discussion about retirement plans, a lot of discussion about health plans, a lot of discussion about that type of thing. Could there be mileage if you have to drive, you know, maybe to an adjacent town to be a teacher? So there's a lot of things still in the air on this one.
David, reported in the North Dakota Monitor, a very interesting story about a mammoth that might be hiding now below a North Dakota garage.
Yeah, and the state geologist, Ed Murphy, is kind of being secretive about where this is, and you understand why.
Obvious reasons, sure.
Very obvious reasons. But a mammoth, I mean, he became aware of this find in 1988, and now he's got a homeowner finding some woolly mammoth bones while digging a foundation for a garage in northwest North Dakota. Interesting. I mean, this whole idea about fossils is absolutely fascinating in North Dakota.
There's some work that was done a while ago. Now there's a garage on the place. They're using ground-penetrating radar and some other things, and they're going to do a test dig around the garage, sounds like, to figure out if Mr. Woolly Mammoth is really hiding below somewhere.
Yeah, we've got, you know, all sorts of dinosaurs and all sorts of aquatic dinosaurs, because North Dakota used to be the home of a pretty deep lake, Lake Agassiz, and also was part of an inland sea back before time.
Just before you started working at Prairie Public.
Exactly. Yeah. As I said, I was there when I fell off my dinosaur.
Dave, tribal communities really have been left without staple foods, and now legislators really are demanding solutions here.
Now, this is extremely interesting because our two U.S. senators are urging the Ag Secretary to try to rectify the situation and get these staple foods to where they're really needed. I think this is going to be kind of watching what happens now. Senator Cramer has talked about the shortages, a gross failure of program management, and USDA need to step in and get this resolved. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens and how they mobilize to do this.
Dave, let's wind up our time with reviewing when election debates now are scheduled here at Prairie Public.
Oh, yes.
You're directly involved with all of these. I think they're so important. I applaud the candidates for their willingness to participate in other parts of the country. That doesn't happen all the time, so I think we're blessed here. So we ought to take advantage and listen to them.
Absolutely. Of course, the U.S. House debate kicks it off on the 26th of September. That's Julie Fedorchuk, the Republican, and Trigvi Hammer, the Democrat. I'll be privileged to be the moderator in that one. Then the U.S. Senate debate on October 2nd. That's Katrina Christensen, the Democrat, and Senator Cramer, the Republican. Matt O'Lean, our colleague, is going to be doing that debate. And then I have the governor debate on the 10th of October with Kelly Armstrong, Michael Coachman, and Merrill Pepcorn. I think that one's going to be kind of fun because you have three candidates. And there'll be a little bit of sparring, I think.
Dave, the great thing is the candidates out of the ones you named, one of them will win, and we get to help pick, and we get to listen to the information that you're going to provide. So thank you for doing that.
Absolutely. Glad to.
Dave, what are you working on?
I've got this fun story with a Fargo, an NDSU professor who is talking about trying to attract more high school and college students into composing. So he's got something he's calling Score Wars.
Read all about it. Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
We review the news each and every week with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, have you ever composed a song?
No.
Neither have I. Matt O'Lean's up next. He reviews a feel-good movie until it isn't. It's called Blink Twice. Stay with us.
The Bush Foundation will be accepting applications for the 2025 Bush Fellowship from September 17th through October 15th. The fellowship is an investment in the people leading change in our region so they can create bigger change in their communities. 30 fellows will be selected and receive $150,000 to grow their capacity, knowledge, and networks to lead. Learn more about how to apply for the Bush Fellowship at bushfoundation.org.
RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan is famous for music like this.
Feeling mad hostile, ran out apostle, flowing like Christ when I speaks the gospel.
And now is making music like this. How old rap lyrics from his teenage years became classical on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public. There's the fanfare that we're all used to every Thursday. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
This week's movie review is Blink Twice. Matt, let's have a little bit of the trailer, and then we'll chat about the movie.
Jazz, Frida, this is my childhood buddy, Cody.
I'm Tom.
Vic, my left and right hand man.
Perfect.
Tom.
Hi. All right, who did this?
This is Frida, Sarah Frida.
Keep hands. Thank you.
This is our resident wonder boy. Heather, Camilla.
Later. Hey,
what's up, man?
I don't know who that is.
We're going to my island for a few days.
Do you guys want to come?
This is crazy. Did we just jet off to a billionaire's island with a bunch of strangers?
No, he's not a stranger.
He's Slater King.
Everybody say, making memories!
Making memories!
You having a good time?
We're having a great time.
We're drinking champagne.
All right, Matt, as you've indicated, this can't be a movie about fun for an hour and 45 minutes, as we were talking off mic.
That's right, because you can tell from the trailer, and I want to tell people, there's a trailer out there that gives away way too much of this movie, so don't watch that. I would suggest not watching that. But most people, if they're familiar with movies, have seen this trailer. Channing Tatum plays a very rich person named Slater King, who has a private island, and he invites two cocktail waitresses to go to the island with him, and of course they go. Maybe lesson number one here, don't go to an island with people you don't know. Okay, that'd be like lesson number one here.
Good lesson.
But there's something amiss. Obviously, you can tell from the trailer something's amiss. Can't reveal what that is. You need to go see it to check that out. But this joins kind of a long list of films that have kind of tapped into people going to a spot, and it's sort of a cult. Something's going on. Get Out. Jordan Peele's Get Out probably did it the best. The Menu with Ralph Fiennes did it really well. The M. Night Shyamalan film Old did not do it as well. The Beach with Leonardo DiCaprio years ago. So there's a whole gluttony of these kind of movies, Craig, where it's sort of like people go somewhere to have a good time and there's a cultish thing going on. And I'm probably tapped out on those. This kind of falls in the middle. I would say it looks really slick. Zoe Kravitz, first-time director. It looks good. It's all dressed up. The visuals are good. People are partying. They're having a great time on the island. But it's a little bit of this all dressed up with nowhere to go film. But the second half of the film gets much more interesting. And so that's where the film really takes off. You start to reveal things. More things happen like that. But I would say it's one of these films which a little more style over substance. There's not a lot of room for a lot of acting going on. Naomi Ackie is the main actress. She's the cocktail waitress. Her and her friend get invited to this island by Channing Tatum. I'm not a Channing Tatum fan. Never have been. He's a former model. I think he's charisma challenged, and I think he's charisma challenged in this role as Slater King. You watch him play this guy, and you're like, how did this guy get to the top of anything in corporate America? Because he's so, I don't know, Tatum just does not do it for me on screen. I think he's kind of semi-boring on screen, and he is in this part. Christian Slater's in this. Haley Joel Osment from Sixth Sense fame. They don't have a lot to do. They're kind of these hangers-on that work for him. So as you watch this film, things get more and more strange. You're going to find out what's going on. I would call this kind of a female revenge fantasy film as well, but I don't want to reveal too much what's going on. So I'm kind of in the middle on this. I like the second half of it, even though things get a little bloody. And I always have a trouble with films that have a mood problem. So much of the mood in the first half of the film is almost like comic and funny. And then, you know, things shift. And so it's this weird shift of moods, and it's a very, in film, it's a tricky thing to walk that line between satire, humor, and tragedy, and slasher film. And somehow they all kind of meet eventually in this movie. I'm always very leery, too, of films where ordinary people suddenly become action heroes, okay? They suddenly become action heroes, and they're swinging knives around and guns, and they know what they're doing, and most people are not equipped to do that under a pressure situation. But that's the movie. So I'm kind of in the middle on this. It only made $7 million at the box office. I'm kind of wondering where the audience is for this movie. I think it'll continue to go down. Word of mouth is going to be, I think, middling on this. Like the second half of the movie, the first half is a little slow to get moving.
As we've talked about before, I'm not a real slasher movie fan.
No.
But, Matt, to me, it's almost, for slasher movies, the way the story is told, mm-hmm. the storytelling in the movie. Is it good here? Do you like the way it's presented?
That's a really good question, and I'm going to answer it this way. The film looks so good, like the visuals, the island, the flora, the fauna. They're eating great food. They're taking drugs. You know, you're just wondering, what is going on here? What is the secret that Slater King's got up his sleeve on this island? I think the film almost looks too good for its own liking, for its own good. And what I mean by that is it looks too good to really get down and dirty, like it needs to get to in the second half of the film. Some slasher films that are better have more of a dark look to them. This is like you're on a resort island, you're on a spa vacation, and then all hell breaks loose, and we're going to find out what is really going on this island. And so I almost think it looks too good for its own good, if that makes any kind of sense.
What are we going to review the rest of the summer, Matt?
Probably the movie Dee Dee, which is next week. That'll open at the Fargo Theater. That's an independent film that's making the rounds. Beetlejuice, September 6th is going to be big. Coppola's Megalopolis, September 27th. That could be horrible, or it could be one of these misfire cult films, not really sure. So we got a lot of stuff coming up for sure.
Let's go to our Oscar trivia.
Okay.
Matt, there are a few films that hold the record for the most Academy Awards in a single year. Name a couple of them.
Lord of the Rings, Return of the King won 11 in 2003. Titanic won 11 in 1997. And Ben-Hur won 11 in 1959.
Should come as no surprise, Matt. You're right on the money. Thanks again for joining us on Main Street.
You bet.
Dakota Date Book follows. Stay with us.
I've been listening to your show on the radio, and you seem like a friend to me.
You're listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that, too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spins adult album alternative music during the week?
There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play.
He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 29th. Competition for the Great Plains was intense as the United States, France, Spain, and Great Britain all sought its resources. Much of the early contact between the native people and the early explorers was peaceful. The natives brought furs to the trading posts and exchanged them for guns, tools, and food. The traders then sold the valuable furs to the European markets. The fur trade between the indigenous inhabitants and the newcomers proved to be lucrative. Rival fur companies engaged in intense competition. Different companies established trading posts in prime locations. These were often near rivers that were convenient for transporting the furs to shipping centers. The American Fur Company established Fort Union in 1828. Over the next 40 years, Fort Union was the most important trading post on the Upper Missouri River, but it was by no means the only one. On this date, in 1833, William Sublette and Robert Campbell established Fort William at the mouth of the Yellowstone River, only 2.5 miles from Fort Union. The fur traders were determined to give the American Fur Company a run for their money, but it was an expensive undertaking. They built a large cabin, a store, a warehouse, a carpenter shop, and a blacksmith shop. The buildings were surrounded by a 15-foot stockade made of cottonwood logs. Desperate to compete with the American Fur Company, Sublette and Campbell attracted fur trappers, who they paid $12 for a beaver pelt when the going rate was $3. That may have been their undoing. A year later, they sold Fort William to the American Fur Company. The American Fur Company then closed Fort William and used it as a storage depot for Fort Union. The Union Fur Company was the next competitor attempting to take on the American Fur Company and built a trading post called Fort Mortimer, 1/2 mile from the Fort William site. Just as Sublette and Campbell discovered, the newcomers were no match for the established company, and the American Fur Company quickly bought them out. Fort Mortimer was demolished, and the salvaged material went into building Fort Beaufort. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central is The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. This week, Jeremy takes a look at the new film War Game, which asks, what if another January 6th happens, only worse? And at 7 p.m. Central, we'll air Science Friday. On Labor Day, Main Street will be preempted with a special Labor Day program. Then next Tuesday, we'll visit Grand Forks and the North Dakota Museum of Art. They have a wonderful exhibit that's about ready to open. That's coming up next week on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.